Welcome to Nature Now, an original production by KPTZ volunteers. Nature Now is a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners, care of naturenow@kptz.org.
Hello, this is Mary Robson for Nature Now. As the week of winter solstice slips in with icy edges, now we'll have a few minutes of increased light daily, growing stronger as the next months proceed. But January, the light just seems to get only slightly brighter. We'll start out with a mystery sound. This is a familiar bird. But you don't hear it really during the winter. So we'll describe it at the end of the program. Today, we are fortunate to meet with Bob Jepperson, who has been on Nature Now before, very happily for us. He will introduce his new book, Wild World Next Door, Getting to Know Your Wild Neighbors. And Bob does more than observe. He writes and photographs an area he has known for decades. Bob's book, by the way, opens to fill your whole lap as you read it. Some of the photos look larger than life size. Some of the leaves and a frog. And Bob, you might want to comment on that life sizeness. But hello, Bob. Welcome back. Tell me about the place you visit. Where is it? How do we reach it? What's it like? Let's take us there to start.
Well, hi, Mary.
Hi.
Yeah, the book is 8.5 inches high by 11 inches wide, but when you open it up, it's 22 inches wide. So I like big sounds, some big birds and big books, I guess.
Well, it's a very comfortable lapful, I will say that.
Well, I'm glad you like it. And the new book, you know, my first book, Wild Love Story, was 81 pages long, which was fine. And as the years went by, I accumulated so many stories that I thought it's time to put together a second one. So the second book is the same size, same format, but instead of 81 pages, it's 197, and it has over 200 color photos in it. But it's not a picture book in my mind. It's a story book. It's a story of the things I follow. Where do I go? Well, the place I go, I live in Anacortes. Actually, I live just south of Anacortes in Skagit County. But we have on this island, Fidalgo Island, over 3,000 acres. We call it the forest lands. It's not only got forest, but it has beaver ponds. And the size allows beavers to actually do what they do. They build a series of ponds behind each dam. It's a wonderful place to be able to go to. It's not a park. It doesn't have, in the section I go to, which is the Little Cranberry Lake section, you don't see restrooms or picnic tables or reader boards or anything that parks have, but it does have trails. So people call it unique, at least rare, for a town to have over 3,000 acres of forest with trails for access.
You said that the trails are almost 50 miles. That's a lot of trail.
It is. It's a lot of trails to maintain. Some of them are more used than others. Some of them are more remote than others. They come in all steepnesses. They're multi-use. A few of them are open to horseback riders. All of them are open to walkers. Some of them are open to mountain bikes, and a few are open to motorcycles seasonally, small trail-sized bikes. I rarely see one or hear one where I go.
It seems to me that what you're doing does not coincide well with a motorcycle.
No, and they tend to go to another section. And so, like I say, I only hear one or two a year. They know where their brothers and sisters are, so they go over to the other section.
Well, I noticed that you begin Wild World Next Door with photos of people. This is really unusual because your gift for photography for animals, we're all used to that. It's wonderful. But the pictures of people, what brought you to introduce the book with people rather than just starting right out with plants and animals?
Well,
humans are animals, but in any case.
Yeah, well, let's see. Maybe I should start by saying that over the years, and it's been almost 14 years of nearly daily visits for me.
Wow.
I meet people out there, and our forest lands attracts wonderful people. And I've gotten to know quite a few of them. I download pictures of them onto my Lightroom software, and it says I've taken over 1,000 pictures of people.
Oh my.
And, you know, they're not only fun to share ideas with, but they can be useful protectors of that habitat. We fight the ongoing tendency of humans to develop undeveloped land. And even in our forest lands, that crops up once in a while. So recently, I've just begun to network with those people in a little more organized way. And hopefully, if we need to give voice to our voiceless wild neighbors, we'll have some people ready to do that. Because of the importance of people out there, I decided to open up the new book with 17 pages and portraits of 22 people and some heartfelt things they've said. Let me grab my copy of the book here and I'll just give you a sampling. So there's a picture of Rochelle and she says, "I come here every day. This is my sanctuary. I come here to let my brain relax." Here's another one. This is Krista. She's a young mother. She has a baby on her back. She says, "Even though this forest isn't mine, I've always felt like it belonged to me. I want to protect it so that it remains in its most natural state forever."
These people are the supporters of the place, as well as being people who enjoy it. It sounds as if it's not as open and free as it could be. That's very startling. It's in danger in a way.
I think that if I understand what you mean, I've observed people walking underneath owls within 3 feet underneath them. And if the person doesn't look up, the owl often holds its position. And that's just an example of what I'm saying. And that is, if we stay on the trails and we don't make a lot of noise, wildlife knows that we're going to pass by. Even the mountain bikes, they know that they're going to pass by. If they stop and look, it's kind of like if you birdwatch from a car, you get away with more than if you stop the car, or particularly if you get out of the car. So our wild neighbors and we humans get along pretty well as long as we follow certain standards.
I think that what I also wanted to tuck into that last sentence was the fact that there must have to be some sort of mission to protect what is there if it is in some way likely to be developed. Mm-hmm. Is this actually possible?
Is it possible to keep it natural forever?
Well, insofar as whatever forever is. But I guess I was thinking of the short term, whether it had experienced any difficulties in the short term that affect how you and the people who love it are moving toward it.
We do. And that would be a lengthy discussion. And my books are celebrations in the pictures and in the stories. I love that place and I love that show. Mm-hmm. And we do have to get political once in a while. That's the negative side of that place. And today isn't the day, if it ever is, to talk about it on this program.
Okay. I was not meaning to throw a rock in the path, which was going very smoothly as your presentations generally do.
Let me pick out just a couple of more quotes from people.
Sure.
This justifies why I put the first 17 pages where I did. Mm-hmm. Here's a woman that runs. She says, "There's no other place like the forest lands. They are my heavenly sanctuary, a place where I recharge." Then here's a woman who has 5 kids and a husband. "Sometimes I see all 7 of them out there, but often I see her alone. And she says, 'For me, this place is life-giving. It keeps It keeps me sane.
That makes perfectly good sense. And we talked a little bit about the size of the book and the way it is so lap-filling. And I noticed you said that you had taken 1,000 pictures of the people alone. You
Yeah.
must have multiple thousands of plants and animals. And
I was
wondering, when I read the book at first, I found myself thinking, Bob must have sorted hundreds of photos for this book. How do you choose? It's amazing.
The photos are nice to look at, but the photos don't lead the way for me. Over the years, what I've narrowed down my mission out there to is finding and following stories. Stories are the way that humans have conveyed information from generation to generation forever. And I don't think of my books as information books. I consciously try to make them not information books. Instead, I'm out there enough that I'm able to find and follow stories, and I tell those stories. And of course, I weave information into them. And then in most cases, I like to have a story, a picture to support the story. I always say that a picture is better with a story, and a story is better with a picture, although there are cases, and I can give you one later here, where a story is probably better with no pictures, because that'll interfere with the reader's chance to visualize along with the story.
Well, I have a quote from you, which I was very pleased to come across. The natural world is like a book of stories. Just as written words give us cues to meaning, the sights and sounds of nature give us cues to meaning as well. That is extremely vivid.
Yeah, and you know, I may have said this, I think this is our eighth broadcast, and I may have said this before, but one of the things I've learned over there is that what we see, the light we take in, doesn't travel very far in a forest. The forest is filled up with things already, whereas sound travels a long distance. So once you learn the meaning of sounds, then you know who's there. If you can identify the sound from an individual source, what species are there, probably what they're doing, and then where they are different seasons of the year. So sound is much more important to me. I love both the sound and the sight, but sound is more important, actually.
Now, I know that you selected a story you would like to read to us, and I absolutely agree that this would be an appropriate place for a story. You said this is a story that actually has no photos, although I will say to the listener that this story is surrounded on its pages before and after with the creatures who are featured in the story. So when you look at the book, you're not really missing who it is that you're talking about. But I would say, charge right in on your story.
That's right. Let me preface it by saying something about the subjects.
Okay.
We have, you know, Skagit Valley is wintertime host to the largest concentration of trumpeter swans along the BC, Washington, and Oregon coast. Around almost 30,000 swans winter down here, mostly on farm fields. We have 7,000 alone on our Skagit County fields, along with the snow geese, the other large white birds that are out there. But strangely enough, a very, very few of the swans prefer to come over to our isolated beaver ponds, and they eat a sparse diet of spindly little algae that they get from the bottom. They tip and dip and reach their long necks down to the bottom and pull up these spindly little algae weeds. They must taste good because their brothers and sisters are over on the farmland just on an all-you-can-eat diet, gorging themselves with farm plants over there, winter rye and so forth. And this year, and most years, a pair come. They're bright white because they're adults. And sometimes they bring along a cygnet, which are full size. They have to be to fly 1,000 miles from Anacortes, from Alaska to Anacortes. And one year we even had a family with five cygnets. And the one signet ended up leaving early. That's another story. But what I'm going to read here is just me watching one behavior on a pond. And it was mom and dad and four of their signets. So here we go. Today, 40 minutes before official sunset, I discover the family of six tipping and dipping along the south shore of the largest pond. For 10 minutes, they feed before swimming north, all six of them, in the dimming light of day. Their vocals change. Instead of uttering the occasional soft sounds that bind them as a family, they ramp up their vocals to create a near steady stream of honks, punctuated with a few short trumpet bursts. They march with an air of excitement as they swim north. The father assumes the position of rear guard, swimming just behind the others who swim five abreast. A few of the swans begin to head bob, flexing their necks up and down, dropping a few inches each time and then lifting them again. Soon, five out of the six are bobbing, their heads moving like pistons in an engine, firing up and down at random, not in unison. Like one line of a high school band, the five head bobbing marchers parade across the pond while my imagination adds the music of a calliope making oom-pa-pa sounds. I can tell that the swans have performed this family ritual many times. I sense a tension, a buildup to something larger. They appear to be taxiing, sizing up their wet runway. Six animated vocalizing head bobbing swans getting revved up and prepped for takeoff. Together, they swim about 200 yards toward the north shore, turn west, then south, and without hesitation, they take flight, not in a line, but in a disjointed V formation. A stampede of bright whiteness surges across the pond as a dozen feet take splashing steps as long wings barely manage to lift their heavy bodies above the wetness. Not an easy task for the largest of our waterfall. I wonder, will they clear the trees at the south margin of the pond? They do not. They veer left and they extend their flyway over the east shore of the pond, all the time working to gain more altitude. Their flight path brings them directly overhead, and I track them with a microphone, recording the sound of it all, the rush of six pairs of wings swishing through the chilly evening air to gain enough altitude to clear the tall trees that border the pond. The wild sounds of six swans echo inside the forest bowl as they finish the last half-mile circular route and again challenge the southern border of the pond. Up they rise in what sounds like a celebration as they breach the forest rim, the six white swans becoming six black silhouettes against the bright evening sky, shrinking in the distance until I can no longer see nor hear them.
Well, that is so vivid. Thank you. That was a fortunate day for those swans if they had known how they would be memorialized by what you have done for them. So that is really wonderful.
Well, thank you.
I wanted to add just a couple more things here. One of the things about your photography is that you show the full range of life and also death. I think this is unusual in nature-oriented books where people seem to just look the other direction if an owl has caught a baby bird, but you don't. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if you can comment on that.
Mm-hmm. I did look the other way with my first book. it was a little like a Disney film. But on this book, I decided to show nature's warts. And, you know, I witnessed things. I came upon a garter snake, a large one, swallowing quite a large red-legged frog. Oh, and wow. I missed the beginning. I left before it ended, but I was still there 2 hours. It's a long, slow, quiet process. And of course, any observer is going to empathize with that poor frog, which was being swallowed tail end first. And at one point, it was swallowed up to its armpit. Oh, anyway, it was interesting. And then, of course, there's the whole issue of owls who attack humans. And I put 9 pages in my book on that. It just irritates me no end to read how the press covers it and calls up somebody and they interpret the behavior with crazy explanations. And so in 2012, I started interviewing people that had been hit by owls. And since then I've interviewed 76. And so I have 20 pieces of data from each interview and their narratives. And I'm now able to generalize on what prompts that behavior. So that's a really long story, but that's in my book. And then there's the case of one day I'm walking down a quiet trail and I notice a barred owl looking down into the slough brush, and I start photographing it, and then it dives into the brush and it comes out with a baby varied thrush.
Oh.
And the parents, of course, are just upset no end. That owl had just one owlet that year, and it was perched nearby on a branch of a maple tree, fortunately open to me for photography. And so I have a few pictures in there, and that mother owl went up to her baby and gave it that large nestling. You wouldn't believe it could even swallow it, head and legs and wings and feathers and everything, but it did. And then the mother owl went back, got a second nestling, came back with it, waited till her owlet finished the first, then gave it the second. And then it went back for a third. It got tangled in the nest. And so it brought the whole nest and got that nestling out and waited there patiently. She could have eaten the nestling herself, but she patiently waited and fed 3 in a row to that. It was like a buffet for that baby owl. And then, you know, all turned quiet. I say in the book that if you walked by there 5 minutes later, you would have had no idea what drama happened in the forest. So
I think this is an unusually helpful approach for a lot of people, because mm-hmm. the tendency to want to think of Disney bunnies bopping through the forest, it's too common. And I'm thankful that you're part of helping people learn.
Now, by the way, I do have a picture on that same subject of a great horned owl with a half a bunny in his grasp.
Oh, help. Your photography is clearly not created on an iPhone. I know this because I have an iPhone and I take pictures with it, and they all look alike. And I don't have the dimension and depth that you get. So I know you've got a lot of equipment, but how do you decide what to carry around on any given day?
Okay, well, I really don't have a lot of equipment. I keep a lot of things in my life very simple. Ask my wife about that. wildlife lenses start at 400 millimeters. Those are the kind you see on tripods at wildlife refuges. The longest lens I have and the one I like to carry is just 300 millimeters, but mobility is important for me. And my 300 millimeter lens and my camera and the monopod it's on add up to 10 pounds, which is the same weight as a junior bowling ball. So I have to carry that with me. And I've kind of developed ways of carrying it that did decrease the wear and tear on my poor old body. And then I have a macro lens. You know, in the book, there's the 2-page story called The Wild Rose Theater with the spider on it. And, you know, I had to have a macro lens in order to get that picture. It's a close-up lens. I don't take many landscapes. Those require a wide-angle lens. So that's my photography equipment. But seasonally, I carry a 22-inch diameter plastic parabola with a stereo microphone in the focal point, and then a cord that runs to a digital recorder. And I love having sound. When something wonderful happens, I can come home and look at the sound. I use Audacity and it displays the sound on the screen. I can count how many taps a woodpecker makes on a tree when it's drumming. I can, to get to know owls as individuals, I recognize about 8 of them by their voices now. So getting to hear it over again and to see it displayed allows me to learn the nuances of the different owls' voices. And when I know them as individuals, you know, that's another subject, Mary. We say, oh, I saw a great horned owl today, but we never say, oh, I saw a human today. Why? Because we consider humans to be individuals, but so many of our wild neighbors, we look at them as clones of each other, and they're not, they're individuals too. And once we learn to recognize them as individuals, we can follow them throughout the year. And my longest story is 8 years with one female and male owl through all their nestings. And because I know her voice, I'm sure it's her.
This is fascinating. I have never had an unfascinating moment with you. I'm so glad that you were able to be with us today. Just as we're about to get into winter, and the solstice is the first Wednesday this week. So this is going to be a wonderful way to get people into the winter solstice, and in a spirit of appreciation. Thank you so much, Bob. I appreciate it.
It's always glad to be with you, Mary.
Okay, great. Thanks. Bye.
Okay, bye.
The mystery sound is the varied thrush. Its habitat is in the Northwest, south to Northern California, and some of them go all the way up to Alaska when they're breeding, which is amazing. But they are distinctly our bird. The varied thrush is a robin relative. It brings vivid color, brownish gold, and activity to the winter scene. The vividness is in the depth of color the markings bring. A distinct dark brown V on the chest of the male, present on the female, but lighter. Their lovely mating call is present as the weather begins to warm. The single notes remind me of someone practicing the oboe. Once you hear it, you will never forget it. Now they are quiet, but noticeable. Their winter foods, berries and nuts, have them hunting. And today I noticed about 5 varied thrush pecking at Catani aster berries from a shrub on a garden edge. The shrub was bouncing up and down from them. And because they live in mature and old growth forests containing very large trees, and they tend to live in forest patches larger than 40 acres, logging and forest fragmentation can cause habitat loss that does reduce their numbers, but they're still here for us to love and enjoy. Thank you for joining us today on the week of winter solstice.